This is the Young Farmers Podcast. I'm Lindsay Lesher-Shute. In 1920, 14% of U.S. farmers were Black. But today, that number is less than 2%. Land ownership by Black farmers has also declined over the last 100 years, from 15 million acres to roughly 2 million acres today. These numbers are tough, but some say they could be even worse without the leadership and cooperative power of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. The Federation has been working for over 50 years to help family farmers in the rural South, especially farmers of color, to stop land loss. The Federation has also been a key actor in building coalitions, such as the Rural Coalition, that created federal programs for people of color, women, and veterans. Today, I am speaking with Cornelius Blanding, Executive Director of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. He has worked with the Federation for 21 years, and has been executive director since 2015. Cornelius talks about why cooperatives were so necessary for the Black community during the civil rights movement, how these cooperatives are doing today, and new challenges facing Black farmers.
Hi, I'm Tess Brown Lavoie, farmer at Sidewalk Ends Farm in Providence, Rhode Island, and board president of the National Young Farmers Coalition. I've been a member of the National Young Farmers Coalition since 2011, because it's important to me to align the work I have the privilege of doing on the land with a broader movement for a more equitable agricultural landscape in this country. For $35 a year, you can join too. In addition to being part of a bright and just future for agriculture in the United States, you'll also get discounts like 10% off Farm Tech and 10% off Vermont Compost. To join, go to youngfarmers.org.
So tell me, what is the current work of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives?
Well, thank you for asking. So simply put, we are a cooperative association of Black farmers, landowners, and cooperatives all around the South. But the work that we do, now, what the Federation is made up of is 75 cooperatives, basically. And that comes out to roughly around 20,000 individual members. Members who are part of those cooperatives, but also individual members of the Federation, who were founded directly out of the Civil Rights Movement 51 years ago. And what we have always done and continue to do is focus around three things, pretty much: cooperative economic development, land retention, and advocacy. So, in essence, we help organize and strengthen cooperatives, but we also provide direct assistance to many of the farmers, landowners, and community members that make up those cooperatives, and more importantly, that make up the Federation. Our technical assistance varies from direct assistance like planning to marketing. We look to figure out how do we better strengthen programs and policies that support the Federation as an organization, its members, whether individual members or cooperative members, and the South in general. And that leads us to a lot of work around the Farm Bill.
Mm-hmm. And Cornelius, could you explain, just so everyone's on the same page, what a cooperative is?
No problem. Simply put, cooperative is pretty much a democratically controlled and owned business, a business that's owned by the people who benefit from it. They own and operate it and make decisions jointly.
And cooperatives have been tremendously important, specifically for the Black community in the South. Can you speak to that a little bit?
And I want to make sure that I'm clear when I say a business. So, and what's unique about a cooperative is that it doesn't just focus on the economic side of business, which typical businesses generally are driven by. Cooperatives tend to look at not only the economics, but the social and the political aspects. And so the importance of cooperatives for us is that it gives individuals, especially limited resource individuals, the opportunity to pool resources and to create a business, to create something that's jointly controlled by themselves. And so for us, and especially in the South and in the Black community, again, I mentioned to you that the Federation was formed out of the Civil Rights Movement. So you had, during the 60s, where many of the Black farmers, landowners, and communities were not participating in the economy. They didn't get equal access to resources, and they didn't have the same right to not only vote, but to participate in the economy. And so those cooperatives gave them an opportunity to come together to pool their resources to provide services to themselves. It gave them an opportunity to learn business and to learn how to participate in the economy. And so cooperatives have always been, for us, engines for economic opportunity. They've always been engines for our folks to work together socially and opportunities for them to participate politically, because they learned structures of businesses. They learned the structures of their communities. They learned the issues, and they began advocating for it. And so it was a leadership development component to it also, where folks left their cooperatives and started running for boards and running for offices. So it was multifaceted, but more importantly, they were creatures of necessity.
How is the cooperative movement in the South? How has that changed? How does it look different, you know, in 2018 than it might have in 1960?
Yeah. So I'm going to beg and say that it hasn't changed a whole lot. Now, some of the specifics have changed, but something that was called one thing in the 60s just called something else in the 2000s. The Federation was formed in 1967, but the idea of the Federation and the beginning work began in 1966, a year earlier. There were cooperatives from about six states, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, Louisiana, et cetera, there were cooperatives that were already formed in the Black community that were starting to form, because we call the Federation kind of a collision between the civil rights movement and the cooperative movement. So you had folks out working in the civil as part of the civil rights movement. They were registering people to vote. They were doing a number of things, but those things came with consequences. And so if you register somebody to vote, or if you went and voted, you could very well be kicked off land. You could very well be kicked out of a job. You would be kicked out from participating in that economy, in that local economy. And so when the cooperative movement took shape in the 60s, where it came around, again, it started giving folks the idea, saying, look, if you're going to boycott, if you're going to do these things, you better have an alternative. So it gave people an opportunity to start creating their own businesses to provide their own services. So you had cooperatives that had already started forming all around the South. For example, you had folks in Alabama who were kicked off their land for registering to vote, and they started creating land buying co-ops. You had people in Tennessee who were just trying to buy gas for their farm who couldn't because of discrimination. They started forming gas buying co-ops where they would go purchase gas and bring it back to Tennessee so they could operate their farm equipment. You had folks who were kicked off jobs who started doing quilt making and created quilt making co-ops. So you had a number of these kind of co-ops that had popped up all during the 60s and before. But in 66, they started hearing about each other, largely because of the cooperative movement and workers from SNCC, from SCLC, from NAACP, and others, from CORE. And those workers knew of each other. They worked in the same communities, and those cooperatives were popping up. And so in 66, they all got together in a place called Mount Beulah, Mississippi, and they started talking about the idea of working together. The resources came about where 22 of those co-ops were able to come together again in 1967 to continue that idea or that conversation they had in Mount Beulah a year earlier. And they left there with forming the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. It was a federation of 22 co-ops. And they created this organization, hired an executive director, a steering committee, and the federation was begun at that point.
I just want to underline what an effort it must have been for each of those communities, and the seriousness. You don't see in this day and age many sort of similar movements where communities are coming together to share resources, economic resources, in that way, because it just goes against so many other aspects of our culture, right? To have this co-op come together and community members to have that degree of trust is really amazing.
You're exactly right, and it points to the crux of the situation for us. And even when you start talking about the challenges of today is how do you organize people? How do you get people to trust each other when they don't see the things that they seen directly in the 1960s? Those needs are still there. They just take on different forms, and they look a little different. They're a lot more subtle. And the challenge for us now is organizing the same way, figuring out new ways to show that need, new ways to keep that need prevalent and up front in front of people. And then if that need is there, they start doing those other things that you talked about. They start developing trust, but again, it's out of necessity. But there's still some things even today where people are not getting fair prices, and you show that need and they'll come together. But again, it's putting the work in to figure out what do people have in common, especially around the need. And then you have a starting point. But it's still just as important, it's still just as needed today as it was in the 60s.
And I wonder, do you still see that same relationship today between the cooperative movement and the civil rights movement? And, you know, in the form, perhaps, that takes today is the movement for Black Lives. How has that related to the work of the Federation?
That's our challenge, and that's the biggest thing that we have to work. It's harder to collaborate now in a society, in an economy, where the need is not as prevalent. But again, because times have changed and people and things are not just right there, and you can't just point to things, but you have to look in the harder now. And so it takes us doing that, but organizations, movements are not working together like they were then, but many feel they don't have to because it's a little easier in terms of the resources that are available to them. All of our movements, at the end of the day, if you keep looking deep enough, they're all connected, whether it's the civil rights movement, the cooperative movement, the environmental movement, the labor movement. They're all, when you get down to the core of them, they're the central need that's there, and it cuts across all of us. But it's always going to take the time to reach out and spend the time with each other to unveil that. That's the challenge, and your point to it, and trying to figure that out while you're trying to still do the work, which is always coming at you and doing the work where resources are forever threatened. It's the challenge.
So, Cornelius, in preparation for this, I heard you on a panel last year speaking about the role of cooperatives, and you were referencing a report by the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights from 1982, and it was talking about the rate of farmer land loss in the United States and the fact that Black farmers had lost land at 2 times the rate of white landowners in the 50s, and then even at a faster rate, 2.5 times as fast by the 1970s. And that same paper talked about that if this rate of land loss were to continue within the Black community, there would be virtually no Black-operated farms in this country by the end of the next decade. So that was the year 2000. And I guess I was hoping that you could speak to that. I mean, clearly there are still many Black-owned farms. And in the young farmer community, we have seen some sort of exciting new growth. Could you just talk a little bit about, like, what this century has looked like for Black land loss and the factors that have influenced that?
Mm-hmm. Sure. This is probably one of the number one issues that we face and that we work on, is probably a large reason for our being as an organization. And the Federation was founded, as I said, in 1967. But in 1985, the Federation merged with an organization at that time called the Emergency Land Fund. And what the Emergency Land Fund did was it basically worked on researching the Black land loss issue, Black land ownership, and looking at the economic opportunities that were needed to stabilize that loss and continue to build a land base in the Black community. In 1985, those two organizations merged, and so it became the Federation of Southern Cooperatives Land Assistance Fund. And in 1910, there were 218,000 Black farmers owning roughly 15 million acres of land. By 1992, there were only 18,000 Black farmers owning roughly about 2.3 million acres of land. And they calculated that, saying that Black farmers are losing land roughly at about 1,000 acres a day. And at the rate that it was happening, by the turn of the century, by 2000, if it continued, there would be no Black-owned land. There would be no Black farms. And so that has been a driving force behind the work that we do. One of the number one reasons that many Black families lose land is because of heirs property, an issue called heirs property. And heirs property is basically where a owner passes away without a will, and the land is passed down through their heirs. And that ownership, that tenure of land ownership, is not secure in the eyes of this country, because it recognizes a owner, and you point to one owner. So now you have a situation where you have heirs owning the land, and they all own it equally, but it's undivided interest, and you can't divide that land up. And so throughout generations, as generations go further and further and pass, you have more heirs, more owners, more division of that land. And all it takes is one person to sell their share to someone who doesn't have the same intentions of the family, or for the taxes not to be paid because there's so much confusion, so much ownership. It's so risky, if you will. And that situation creates is one of the main reasons for loss of land. Dude, I wasn't a farmer, but I came to this work with a connection to the land, which most folks do. And if you point and if you throw a rock in any black community, the person you hear, I can guarantee they have some heirs property in their land. I lost their land due to heirs property. And the same thing was with my family. We lost land in Alabama due to heirs property. So the work becomes personal. And that situation is still a big problem for us as a community. It's one of the main things we work on as an organization, and it continues. But the other problem was discrimination. And in 1999, USDA, our Department of Agriculture, admitted that it discriminated against black farmers over those years, and it resulted in the largest lawsuit in this country, the Pickford case, Black Farmers versus USDA, and it was admitted. And so black farmers lost land because of discrimination. They lost land because of heirs property. So our work stems around developing programs and outreach methods to stem that tide. So for heirs property, we have a network of attorneys and other partners who work on heirs property issues, who work on wills and estate plans for farmers, for landowners, for families, to figure out how to stop debt from happening. And so it's important that we develop programs to help with debt, but also policy, which brings us things like the Farm Bill. And so in the Farm Bill, there were one policy in particular that you asked me about, which was 2501. And something back in 1990, the Federation took the lead on, and it was a brainchild of the Federation. At that time, it was called the Minority Farmers' Right Bill in 1990, which eventually became Section 2501 of the Farm Bill. But what it did was provide resources to community-based organizations to provide technical assistance directly out there to black farmers and landowners. But now it has grown, grown in terms of the number of people who are engaging in 2501, but the resources haven't grown. So it, in essence, has been diluted. And now a bill that we were responsible for, the Federation, we don't even get anymore. But there was research that was shown back in the late 80s, late 90s, early 2000s, which showed that the 2501 was having a significant impact and that land ownership in states like Alabama and Georgia had started turning around where they weren't losing those 1,000 acres. So we know that it works, and those resources are impactful for our community. It's the work, but it also the work in terms of policy. And so we're also looking now in terms of, there's a bill that's in Congress now, that's in Farm Bill, that's in the conference committee around heirs property, so that USDA can now start recognizing folks that they have over 50% ownership in the land. They can show authority over 50% that they can then get access to those programs to get those resources that play a role not only in helping with farm loans and farm management, but also around conservation. So as I said earlier, our movements, whether they're civil rights movement, cooperative movement, or the environmental movement, they're all connected when you get down to the most basic elements of it.
What percentage of black-owned land, is there sort of a number that establishes like how much of black-owned land is heirs property? Is that known, or do you have a guess?
It's a great question. I can't give you the specific number now. Somebody in our organization can, but I will say this, that back 35 years or more, it was a majority of landowners had heirs property, and over 60% of all black-owned land is heirs property.
And the reason that the landowners did not establish a will, what's the answer to that question?
There's a number, but I'm going to point to two. The two major reasons. One, education, not understanding and knowing about wills and estate planning. Two, having the resources to get it done, to get an attorney to do a will or an estate plan. And three, which is probably even more so than the first two, culture. In our communities, and I'm going to speak personally about it, on my mother's side of the family, her father passed the will down. It was passed down from his mother and her mother in Alabama. And they didn't believe in a will because they said, we're not going to give the land to one person or one child. what we're going to do is let the pass it down, and all my kids are on it. But they didn't know the ramifications back then of heirs' property. They didn't know the ramifications that it had on access to USDA programs. They didn't have access to those things anyway. They didn't think about that then. But that pattern, that culture, that lack of education was passed down. And so now you have in our communities where folks, instead of paying for a will, for something that you don't understand, to give control of your land to one child, you do nothing and all your children own it. That would make sense to me. It's the most sensible solution. But it's not. It's a part of the problem. And so what we have to do is educate our communities on their other options.
And so when a property is passed down in this way, the new set of owners, because they own such a small stake in the property, they're unable to access like a Farm Service Agency USDA loan or Natural Resources Conservation Service conservation programs that might help them establish fencing or do cover cropping or that type of thing.
Exactly. So just say in a real scenario where you pass down, let's say 40 acres. 40 acres is passed down to a family, passed down from a grandmother or whatever to 10 kids. You got 10 kids now all owning a share of 40 acres. And first of all, that land hasn't been producing where it's profitable, and it's not profitable for 10. And even if it was, 10 kids don't all stay in one place. They move on, but they take their ownership still with them. And so now, as generations pass, you might be two generations removed from somebody who has moved to New York, and now their grandchild has a stake in that land and don't even know it. And there's taxes that are happening every year in Alabama, and it's the part of the family that stayed down there who's stuck with that, let's call it a burden, because the land is not generating any income. And so they're tied now paying it. And they said, well, look, everybody else got to pay their share. Person in New York not willing to do it. So that person may say, well, look, you know, I'm not going to keep paying it by myself, but unaware of the ramifications of it. Or you can have somebody who's unaware in New York, that same grandchild who's approached by an unscrupulous attorney who says, hey, you own a share of 40 acres in Alabama that ain't doing that and it's costing this and that. I'll give you $5,000 for it. And that person don't even know that land, never been to it, hadn't talked about it. They take the $5,000. The attorney now is an equal owner in there. He's one of the heirs now, or she is one of the heirs now. And they can go back and try to force the family to do something that the family's not willing to do. And on the grounds of the family can't agree, it can force a sale, call a forced partition sale. And a judge puts it on the courthouse steps to sell it, and that same attorney and the organized folks to be out there to bid on it and bid higher than the family ever could bid on it. Still below the market value, but bid on it. So really understanding all those pieces, but it's a real situation that happens every day in our community. But it also gets down to what you do in terms of the young farmers. So now that is one aspect, a first-generation farmer being able to get access to some land in an area. But let's add it on from another side. What about those folks who might be fourth, fifth, or sixth generation farmers, but their land is tied up in their property? Ralph Page, my mentor, my predecessor, back in the 90s, I think, he said that, you know, this is an issue of just a black farmer losing land. It's not just losing a farmer. It's somebody is losing a piece of this country. And our community loses a piece of this country every time we lose land.
You mentioned in one of your talks about the importance of land ownership and how important black land ownership is to the country and the world, in fact. And I wondered if you could just speak to that.
Yeah. No, definitely. It's an extension of what I just said. This country is one of the only, if not the only country that's majority privately owned. So any work that our government does, NRCS or any other agency, USDA or any other agencies within the agency, any work that they do, you have to do through private landowners who own a portion of this country. And so as we lose land and as black farmers lose land, we lose a piece of this country. We lose a piece of our home. We lose a piece of our right to say so and do things. We lose an economic base. The community, the town, the t- county, loses the state, loses a tax base, tax revenue, but also there's conservation ramifications behind it, because the people who are on the vanguard of conservation and environmental issues are small farmers, and many are black farmers. Every piece of land, including especially a black farmer's land, is important to the overall strategic objective of this country, whether it's environmental, conservation-wise, or economic. It's important because it deals with the conservation of this country. It deals with the economic base of this country. And so I think we have to make sure that we look at it and know that we're all tied together, and especially black farmers. We have to deal with every farmer, small farmers, and including black farmers, to deal with our conservation issues and our economic issues in this country. When people don't have a good economic base, they migrate. And they migrate, and that leads to crowded cities, but it also leads to development of our rural communities. And as our rural communities die, I think parts of this country die.
That is absolutely so true. I was having a conversation last week with a young Apache farmer in Arizona, and he was just talking about how the elders in that community talk about how where they are is the center of the universe, and just really bringing such importance to place and to home. And I feel like that has relevance to this conversation and just land ownership, right? Like, you have to have that grounding and rooting. And when we lose that, we lose so much.
Well, I would echo that elder's comment. It actually is something that's frequently said within our organization.
Do you see young people coming to the cooperative movement? And is there succession within cooperatives? I mean, it's very fraught when it comes to land, but are you seeing interest within young farmers, young black farmers, to carry on these traditions and critical business entities?
I do see young farmers and young black farmers coming on, and I see it because I have to see it. And if I can't see it and don't see it, I don't work on it. And the minute we don't realize the importance of young farmers, and for us as a federation, young black farmers and young folks coming into the cooperative movement, is the minute that our movement, our organization dies. And so that is a critical piece of our work. We have a Sankofa Youth Project, where we give young folks in the community an acre of land every year to work on, to build their agricultural skills and their interest in agriculture. We provide scholarships every year from something we call the Pat Jackson Scholarship Awards to some of those folks that are coming out of that program and their community and out of our membership to go to the land-grant universities. We also work hard in terms of making sure that our cooperatives look at this from a transitional standpoint, similar to what we've done as an organization. And if you look at us, we started with 75 cooperatives, 22 who founded the Federation. Those 22 cooperatives are not still here. So those 75 cooperatives don't make up those 22. There's some going and there's some coming. And the some coming usually are younger, but the ones that are staying have to realize they have to bring on young farmers or young co-op members. So the youth are the lifeline of the cooperative movement and of our organization and of all organizations, I would contend. But there is a challenge. The Beginning Farmers Program is something that we hold dear to our hearts, but we have to put that in the context of heirs property. And so that issue also takes us to young farmers. So we also build that into what we call co-op econ, where every year we bring young folks to Alabama, to our training center, to one, network with each other, but more importantly, to learn and relearn co-op 101. So we're excited about the future. There's a lot of new co-ops who make up the Federation. There are not a lot of new co-ops and co-op members and young farmers who we see at Co-op Econ. We see them at the forestry camp. We see them at our Young Farmers Program, at the Youth Project. And so figuring out how do we build this work together, and how do we look down the road and realize that at the end of the day, when you get back to it, if you go deep enough, you will see that common need.
So as of October 1st, The 2501 program that we talked about earlier is among these stranded Farm Bill programs. So there is no longer funding for them until we have a new Farm Bill that includes those programs. And we have been very pleased to see in the Senate version of the Farm Bill, there are two good things, I would say. There is language in the Senate version of the Farm Bill that would help with this significant issue of heirs' property. And then there's also the Farming Opportunities Training and Outreach Marker Bill and program put together, which actually combines the Beginning Farmer and Rancher Development Program, Beginning BFRDP, and the 2501 program, and increases the funding for 2501 and would actually give both of those programs permanent baseline funding. So when the next Farm Bill rolls around and there are too many other things going on in the political cycle to actually pass a Farm Bill on time, we would still have funding for those programs. I'm just wondering, from your perspective, like, what's at stake right now with not having 2501 funded for the Black farmer community and for the Federation? As I mean, we've talked about the heirs' property situation. It seems like the Senate provision could be really helpful when it comes to helping those farmers working on heirs' property to be able to access USDA programs.
So then I'm going to work and talk backwards when you ask me what's at stake. What's at stake for us is the success of this country is at stake. And I say that honestly. The conservation and environmental issues of this country are at stake. A piece of this country is at stake. Who owns this country, whether it's small landowners or corporations or other countries? Who owns this country is at stake. And again, depending on who owns this country dictates the success of it, dictates the conservation of it, dictates the economic base of it, dictates the local economies, dictates the farming system of it. So that's what all at stake, because as these programs go, our land is at stake. Again, land that's owned by small family farmers, land that's owned by communities, land that's owned by Black farmers, land that's owned by the Black community. That's all at stake. And the ownership of this country dictates the conservation efforts of this country. It dictates the success of this country. It dictates the economic base of this country. It dictates how people participate in this country, even down to voting. At one time, you had to be a landowner to vote. And so who knows where things go or go back to. So I think that what's important and what's at stake is the land. And the land generates everything else from it. And again, the overall success of this country, from environmental to political to economic, all of it is at stake. And it may seem like a small thing, but I think it's those small pieces that we work on every day that make that splash that gets bigger and bigger that ends up being the splash that we all see around the world. This country is at stake. This land base is at stake when you ask that question. And it may seem like small programs, a small amount of resources. Those resources, they need to be talked about and discussed and developed in a way that they benefit the people who are using them. And I don't think they fully do that. They've been further diluted. So there's a lot of work that we can do on all of those programs, and especially 2501 in terms of getting them back to their original intent. But regardless of what they look like, they're at stake, and we need to fight for them, and we need to figure out how do we all fight for them with an understanding that is connected to us all, and is all connected to the land base and the future and the success of the country. But there's a lot at stake to answer your question.
It's critical to not just narrow in on, like, this program does this thing and this is important for these reasons, but just to really be very honest that the Farm Bill means much more than that. And I totally agree. The fate of this country is at stake in how we support our small landowners, our small farmers, our family farmers, and ensure that rural America is healthy, because it impacts everyone's health in one way. Cornelius, thank you so much for your work, for all that the Federation has done throughout its history. And we really look forward to working together and encouraging some of our members to participate in the work of the Federation.
Well, Lindsay, you're welcome. And again, thank you for your work. And I do look forward to working with you and connecting the dots and figuring out how we work together on various issues. So you're welcome, and thank you as well.
Cornelius, thank you for being on the show today. Find more resources about the Federation of Southern Cooperatives in today's show notes. October is also National Co-op Month. 1 in 3 Americans are members of a co-op, and over 2 million are members of agricultural cooperatives. So how do you think cooperatives can make a difference today? Tell us on our new Instagram. We're at Young Farmers Podcast. Also on the Instagram, you can find a picture of a goat drinking beer. This is to promote a new paper by our recent guest, Dr. Nathan Mueller. Nathan just published a paper on how the global beer supply will be impacted by climate change. Find the link to that article on our Instagram. Please hit subscribe and let us know how we're doing in iTunes. It really does help more people find the show. This podcast was edited by Hannah Beal and recorded with generous support from Radio Kingston. See you next week.